The aim of this session is to think about where we can do our full-time Bible teaching. Should we go into the Anglican Church? Should we go into the Free Church? Should we go into parachurch organizations? Should we do something else altogether? The first part of this talk might seem aimed primarily at men looking to minister in this country, but I hope that there will still be useful principles that will apply to everybody. Apart from anything else, it will help us to understand the church scene that all of us have to live with in this country. But later on, about halfway through the session, Leonie and Rob will be speaking to us specifically about the particular issues relevant to women looking for areas in which to do full-time Bible teaching, and for people thinking of doing Bible teaching in a cross-cultural situation. But let's begin, then, with the mainline denominations in this country. Anglican, Free. There are huge advantages in going into either of those denominations, or when I say either, I suppose the Free is many denominations, any of those mainline denominations, mainly because they are already established. The big, difficult spade work of setting up a church has been done. And if you get a job in one of those churches, you're well into having a congregation already there. The building is already there. It's all up and running. Relatively unimportant, but not entirely negligible things like a salary and a pension are all there, up and running. It's much easier to explain to friends and family what you're doing. If they say, "What are you doing?" and that you say, "I'm a minister in St. Margaret's, Lower Hampstead," or whatever it is, they understand that. They can relate to that. It is acceptable. There are also, however, huge disadvantages with both of them, or with all the denominations. In particular, the very fact that they are already established means that we are constrained by what is there, and what is there may not be great. There will be structures and there will be traditions that we will find uncomfortable and that we do not like. And it will be very hard to change because people are reluctant to change. So having something already there is an advantage because you walk into something, and a disadvantage because you walk into something. Let me try to unpack some of those advantages and disadvantages, and I'm going to do it by interviewing Paul Clark. Clarkie, can I drag you up here, please? And we've got one tape machine, so we're going to have to share the microphone. We can always edit. Well, if you want, then do that. Let me begin. Basically, I've got four questions for Paul, so let me just let you know and Paul know what the questions are, and then we'll take them. So we're going to look first at the advantages of teaching the Bible in the Anglican denomination, then the disadvantages of doing that, then the advantages of teaching the Bible in the Free Church, and then the disadvantages of that. Let's begin with the advantages of the Anglican. Paul, what are the advantages of teaching the Bible in an Anglican denomination?
Thank you. Others may want to add to this as we go. I'm just thinking through these things for myself. Obviously, I've just come to the conclusion that I'll probably try it in the Church of England if they'll have me, and if not, then we'll go and do something else instead. Just before I talk about advantages and disadvantages, I think for me, a critical thing that you need to think through before you, as you make this decision whether to go Church of England or not, is to see whether or not there's any particular theological issue or principle that becomes so overriding for you in, as you study Scripture, as you pray, as you talk to others, that would make the decision for you. For example, for many folks, the issue of baptism, be that because they believe strongly in baptism of infants, or they believe strongly in baptism only of those who are already believers, becomes a defining issue in and of itself. And I think most of us would want to encourage you not to do anything against your conscience. So even if you can see a greater number of pragmatic advantages in going into the Church of England, for example, if as you study the Scriptures, you come to a very settled adult Baptist position, then we would, I guess, encourage you to go with that if you can find a denomination that shares that particular position without taking it to extreme. Do you want to come back on that already?
Can I come back on that already and say, should a secondary issue like baptism actually be shaping our ministry?
In lots of ways, I think the answer to that question is no. On the other hand, you do have to make a decision about where you're going to go. And it seems to me that you do have to make certain promises as you go into the Church of England, for example, and as you get ordained into the Church of England, that I think if you're actively saying, if you're actively making vows that you know that you are not going to keep and you know that you are going to disagree with right from the outset, then I think you get into the habit of compromising your convictions at the start, and there's enough pressure to do that in Christian ministry that I wouldn't start out on that road. So, for example, when you get there are two kinds of ordination in the Church of England. The first, you get ordained as a deacon, and then a year later, normally you get what they call priested or made into a full presbyter, someone who's then got authority to go and run a church themselves. In the ordinal, the list of kind of liturgy that you say at those different ordinations, as they're called, when you're getting ordained as a deacon, you make a promise that you will go and that you will baptize infants, should your vicar ask you to do so. You don't actually say that when you're getting ordained as a presbyter or as a bishop, but I think that it's such a normal part of what's going on, you're not actually allowed to refuse to ordain infants when you're a minister of a congregation. But what did I say? Ordain. Okay. Yeah. You probably are allowed to ordain infants as well. I mean, they're pretty lax on these things. Yeah. So though it is not the most important issue in the world, and personally for me, as I looked at the mainline Baptistic denominations, believer baptizing denominations, they make a bigger issue of it in such a way that, you know, you're second class, you're not allowed to receive the Lord's Supper in many Baptistic churches unless you've been baptized possibly for the second time as an adult, and it seems to me that they make a bigger issue of it, but we're not going to go on to all of that kind of stuff. But I think nevertheless, baptism is an important issue, and I think it would be, personally I think it would be unhelpful, naive even, to go and make a decision to go into the Church of England without at least having worked it through and come to the conclusion that yes, I am willing to work within those structures and if necessary to be baptizing infants. There are useful things to read. Talk to us afterwards if you want to know that. The other principal issue that has affected, theologically, that has affected things for people in the past is that of church government. In theory, again at your ordination, you agree to submit to your bishop, your local bishop, in all matters lawful. As you go about your ministry, you promise that you'll only conduct services in line with what the Church of England has laid down in its liturgical books. St. Helens has an exemption on that, and has done since the 1970s, which is why we don't have to do that on a Sunday. But in most churches that you go to, you would be promising that you're going to do that. And it's just worth knowing that you would be promising to do that if you go into that particular side of things. On the issue of what does it mean to submit to your bishop, I think it's worth realising, we were helped as a staff to think through this when Philip Jensen was over a few months ago. There's been dispute in sort of canon law history as to what it means to submit to your bishop in all matters lawful. Does it mean that unless the bishop, that you have to do everything he says unless he tells you to do something that is directly contrary to scripture, which has been the way that bishops have understood it over the last few years, I guess? Or does it mean that you only have to do the things that the bishop has been empowered and given the legal authority to command you to do? And that's the way that we've understood it in the last few years, I guess. So that the bishop you do make a promise that you will only conduct services in line with the prayer book, as it were, or the common worship, as it now is, and the bishop can require you to do that, you submit to him. He has been given that authority. So as he seeks to enforce that upon you, you are required to obey him. If he tells you to jump up and down on one leg every time you preach, he has not been given the authority to do that. There's nothing against in Scripture that outlaws that as a practice. So if it's that former interpretation that you have to do it unless there's something in Scripture against it, you would then have to jump up and down on one leg every time you preach. Actually, he hasn't been given the authority to require you to do that, and therefore you're perfectly at liberty to say no at that point. Should we take a question? Yeah, go on, Pete. Personally, I'd agree with you, mate. Personally, I think that we've got an obligation first and foremost to God and not to those in authority above us. It's interesting when the Anglican Church talks about the church, in most of its documents, it's talking about the local church rather than about the church denomination. Nevertheless, there is some sense in which you're under the authority of your bishop. And when it comes to church planting and other things, life is made just very, very much easier for you if your bishop is on side. We'll talk about that in a second. And therefore, though there is that obligation there, you have to pick your fights in those situations and decide what are the things that you're going to make a big issue of. And if he's got a particular issue with wearing robes and he's going to fight you on that to the point of trying to get you ousted or to the point of suspending the living such that when the next person comes in after you, he doesn't get the job for life. He only gets a 5-year license that the bishop then has the authority to renew or not to renew. You just got to pick your fights on that, I think. But there is your primary obligation is to God, not to your bishop. Nice. Do you want to say anything on that? You asked me the advantages of going into the Church of England. I think there are several, talking to some of the others that are in this position. I think one of them is that they pay for your training. I was talking to a friend when I was trying to work through these issues, and he said, he took me out for lunch and said, look, I've got three very big reasons why you should go into the Church of England rather than anywhere else. And I said, what are they? And he said, money, money, and money. which I think was helpful in one sense to me, in that I'm not saying that money should be the be-all and the end-all, and it shouldn't be the primary motivating factor, but it is an issue that it costs about £40,000 in this country to train for 3 years at theological college. Sometimes, is it even more than that, Leonie? Is it probably close to 60? You can do it on less, including your fees and stuff. Okay, apparently you can do it on less. Those are the figures that we get quoted when we when we look at this kind of thing. In the region, 30 to 40,000? Is that fair? Either way, you've got to be able to raise. If you're going to go as an independent, the non-Anglican denominations will very, very rarely pay for you to go and do that. There are some funds out there that you can have access to, but they're quite difficult to get hold of, and there's not a huge amount in them as far as I understand it. And therefore, £30,000 or £40,000 is an issue. If if they are willing to sponsor you and to pay you to get on and do gospel ministry, in some sense it makes sense to take advantage of that and to accept the money that's on offer to be trained and for your pension and for your housing and the kind of things that are there. That's one issue, that they pay for your training. It's not the only issue, but it's important. I think there are advantages in the Church of England in that, whatever you think of the rights or wrongs of this, in most places, it doesn't work quite so much in an urban context like St Helens, but there will be people in the local congregation, in the local area, who will come to you every time they have a baby and they want to get it baptized, every time they want to get married, and every time someone in their family dies. And those three kind of hatch, match and dispatch, as they're called, are great evangelistic opportunities, because whenever someone comes to you and says, look, we're thinking about baptizing our child, you need to say to them, and I think even you're required to say to them, do you understand what that means? And so you can send them on a on a Christianity Explore course or something similar for them to understand the Christian faith, so that they understand the vows that they're making as they promise to bring up their child in knowledge and fear of the Lord. When they come to you for marriage, it gives you a wonderful opportunity to do a marriage prep course with them, in which you explain what marriage is in the Bible's terms, and so on. Again, when people die, it's often a time that their family, as you've helped them through the grieving process, are particularly open to asking about life after death. There are pressures that come with those things. We're kind of doing advantages and disadvantages all rolled into one.
Yeah, okay.
there are pressures that come with that. In that, it can end up absorbing quite a lot of your time doing that kind of thing. There's a place in Luke's Gospel where Jesus says, "Let the dead bury their dead," and it can distract you from getting on with your gospel ministry if you end up your whole time burying people who have never been to the church, whose family don't live in the area. You're not going to have any contacts with them afterwards. But you know, one guy I know who in his 3-year curacy performed 100 funerals, and just the amount of time that takes to get on and that gets in the way of other things that you might be doing as you're seeking to advance the gospel. Those are pressures that come with that, and guys in the free church very often are free from that. But there are opportunities evangelistically there as well. And something we found in Canary Wharf, another advantage, is that of access. The fact that as in Canary Wharf we've been trying to build a gospel work out there, the fact that as we knock on the guy who runs Canary Wharf Group PLC, as we knock on his front door and ask to have a meeting with him and ask to talk to him about the possibility of us having a room in the area and that kind of thing, the fact that when he asked us, we sort of said that we were a church, and he talked to us for a few minutes, and then he came back and said, "What kind of church are you?" And the very fact that we could say the local Anglican church, I think, changed the way that he related to us. Had we said at that point that we were the local whatever it was church, or the local independent church, I think in his mind he would have identified us with something that he wanted to be more nervous about, something a little bit more cultic and something a bit weirder. There is that access. Little did he know how weird we actually are. there is that access point, which I think is very useful within the Church of England. It is the case around the country for as long as the church is established, until the politicians get upset with it and disestablish it. That there is the case that at the moment every single area of the country, every single inch, is covered by a local church, and the parish system means that every single person has a local parish church. And in some sense, the minister has the right to walk in and talk to people and to perform the role of being their local vicar, with all of the evangelistic opportunities and stresses that can bring with it. But it gave us an access through the front door in several situations that I don't think we would have had were we someone else. I think that's partly anecdotal, but I think it and that may diminish as the years go by over the next 20-30 years, but for as long as there are people around who identify with the church, even if they're not Christian at all, I think that that's going to be useful. Michael's mentioned the advantage of there being buildings. One of our huge difficulties in Canary Wharf, again, I've just seen that the absolute agony it is, both financially and in terms of organisationally, to try to be organising a church when you haven't got a building to meet in. A lot of free churches have buildings, so that's not an issue, but the very fact that in most of the kind of town centres around the place, the Anglican church was built in quite a prominent location, can be a huge advantage for the gospel and lead to all kinds of opportunities that would not be there otherwise. It's not a straight, "Oh, look at the buildings, let's go that way." They do cost a fortune to keep up as well, and there can be disadvantages that go along with them. But if you think in St. Helens, the land that we are on, if we were renting that on a year-by-year basis, it would cost us upwards of probably a couple of million pounds to have the square footage that we have, even if we were only one floor of a building that size. So there are huge advantages in the fact that the buildings are there, and that the land is owned in perpetuity, which are difficult in other settings. I think one of the advantage, another advantage, I'm rambling slightly, forgive me, I think the very fact that the Church of England, this parish system that I mentioned, the very fact that, within the Church of England you're supposed to be the church for everyone that lives in your locality, it makes, whereas by definition within most free church denominations, you are the church of the people who have chosen to be there, makes it easier to build an evangelistic mindset and culture, to my mind, within an Anglican church than it is within a free church. My experience of travelling around the place and talking to people on both sides of the fence is that it's true that some Anglican churches are very kind of in on themselves and retentive about stuff, and some free churches are wonderfully outward looking and evangelistically minded. But I think on balance across the place, you'd have to say that it seems to be easier to get that the most Anglican churches have a sense that they should be serving the community. And once you can train them to see that the way that you serve the community is by preaching the gospel to them, which takes time in most settings, I think that mindset, that evangelistic mindset, is just easier to inculcate and to train. That might just be my perception, I don't know, within an Anglican church than within a free church. Because very often you'll find that the free church belongs to the people, you're going to come back at me on that and say, the free church belongs to the people who have chosen to be there, by definition, and slightly theologically as well, it's very much more insider-focused. As you speak kind of to people about the theological convictions, if you talk to William about the definition of the church family, he would have a very open and inclusive definition of the church family. There's no formal membership. You can take communion if you turn up, and we give the warning from the front. It's on your own head if you're not trusting Christ, and if you're not in good standing with other Christians, then it's on your own head as you take this. In most free churches, there's quite a tight, not necessarily in evangelical free churches, but in most FIEC churches and Baptist churches and Presbyterian churches that I know of, there's a very tight definition of church membership, and you have to be a member before you're allowed in, and those kind of things. And that, therefore, makes it much more difficult to produce an outsider a mindset. You're going to come back on that?
No, I'm just going to speed you up.
Okay, sure. One other final pro for the Church of England. Again, there are all disadvantages with these, and you can just invert them for cons and stuff like that, so I'm almost done. Within the Church of England, the church government structure leaves the minister free to lead in a way that is not always the case within other denominations. In most other denominations, there's a plural eldership of leaders within the church. And the leaders within the eldership together, of whom the minister of the congregation, it may be the senior elder, or may just be an elder on the panel and someone else chairs the thing, but would normally be the chair of the elders meeting. In most cases, it's that eldership group that take the decisions and so on. And the experience, if you go into a church that's not entirely sold out on the gospel already, and you're trying to turn it around, I've had particularly bad experiences of eldership systems, and particularly good experiences of the Anglican system, and that may have kind of altered my thinking. But up in Durham, we had some folks on the eldership of the church at Claypath when Bob Farr first arrived there, who I think quite clearly now probably were not Christians at the time, and yet they were making the decisions about the spiritual direction that the church was going to go in. And once they're there, and until you have a massive dust up with them, it's very difficult to get them off. It can work out in that way on a PCC in the Church of England, and in some sense the minister is held to account by his church council within the Church of England, but the number one is just more free, it seems to me, to lead. That can be a disadvantage, because he can go herring off in one direction without ever taking without ever bothering to train the congregation so that they come in the same direction with him. And it's a disadvantage in that means that there's lots of bad vicars all over the place who are leading churches and totally up the garden path, and no one can do anything to stop them because they are free to lead and they've got the living of the parish and so on. But it seems to me that on balance, if you're trying to do the right things, that there is more freedom to lead within the Church of England. Having said that, I think one major advantage of the of the free church and therefore disadvantage of the Church of England is that you've heard us already this weekend, and you will hear it much more, no doubt, as this Archbishop thing continues to run, talk about the need to fight within the denomination if you're going to go into the Church of England. The Church of England is absolutely up the garden path on all sorts of issues. There are people all over the place that don't believe the gospel, that are practicing horrendous morality, and are actively endorsing those who are also doing the same thing. It is totally and utterly corrupt. Good men are getting turned down from being allowed into the Church of England as ministers in some cases, and it's pretty ropey stuff. The picture that you get of it at St. Helens is not an accurate picture of what's going on. There is a need to fight the whole time. And in lots of smaller churches, a lot of what you're doing is, or wanting to do as the Church of England minister, is hindered by the fact that you have to spend a huge amount of time fighting, or some would say playing political games with others in the area around you, if you haven't got the sufficient level of kind of financial independence to do some of the things that St. Helens is able to do, and you haven't got the sufficient force within the local area, therefore, that both size and finance brings to you. When you're starting out in a thing, you can be refuse the right to employ a curate, and you can be have all other sorts of things going. There is a huge fight to be had in the vast majority of local churches if you're trying to go about doing a gospel work. On the other hand, in many of the free churches in this country, the majority of your fighting will be internal, trying to get people to get on and do gospel work within the thing, and to stop looking in on themselves and just being insider friendly, but to be outsider friendly. But I was talking to a great friend who's also a Bible teacher in a Presbyterian kind of church, and he would, you know, he hears all these talks every time we go on about fighting liberals and stuff like that, and he says, look, just not being funny, but he's never met a liberal, and he's never had to deal with one, and he's never had to try and talk to one. Everyone in his congregation understands kind of the 5 points of Calvinism better than he does. It's just not an issue for him to have to fight liberals, and in one sense that's a huge advantage, because he's sharing common ground with the people in his congregation, and with all of those with the other people in his denomination, as it turns out. But that's both a strength and a weakness, because people who are so sure of their theology, it's much harder to show why they're wrong when they just won't get on and do gospel work.
Well, that's powerful,
eh? Go on. Yeah, I think that's right. And structurally, that in some of the denominations, again, each one's different, but in some of them, there is no sense of accountability to the wider structure, and therefore the local congregation is just free to get on with it. And just because they've been much stronger across the board at fighting for doctrine in some of those places, they've just won a lot of the battles, and the liberals have all stayed in the Church of England instead of going and joining them. Nigel, have I been unbalanced? Are there other things I should have said?
I think it's just worth adding that theological formularies,
yeah,
or final formularies of the Church of England are good.
Yeah, thank you.
The book on prayer and articles is evangelical, and we're the true Church of England.
Yeah. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. I think one of the huge problems, and it's a challenge for each of us as we were thinking yesterday, is that evangelical ministers have not chosen to go to deprived areas. So Andrew Jones on staff at St Helens would say that he's talked to local bishops and archdeacons and stuff, and the hardest jobs that they have to fill ever when it comes to kind of Church of England churches coming up for grabs and needing a new leader, the hardest jobs that they find to fill are inner city evangelical churches. They get many applicants for liberal inner city churches, and they get loads of people wanting to go and work in Hampstead. Not that there's anything wrong with working in Hampstead, they need the gospel just as much as anyone, but that there are loads of people that are willing to go and do that. There are fewer evangelicals that are willing to go to Dagenham or to the Isle of Dogs and to do those kind of things. So I think it can be the case. One issue on the buildings thing, it's a huge advantage if you've got this great building and you can seat 1,200. In Limehouse, where we're at, the local school down the road is 97% Bangladeshi and therefore Muslim. 3% white, some of the things that the people are Christian. It's a Church of England school, I think. But that's the case anyway. Those folks... And there's this huge, I don't know what century, Hawksmoor building that St Anne's use on a Sunday. The Muslims will never walk through the front door. And therefore, when you're saying, how are we going to reach the local area, you're going to have to go and start things, even though you've got this great building that you could do all sorts of wonderful things with, you've got to go and start something totally different down the road in a shed, because they just will not walk through the front door. So there are advantages, disadvantages that go along with the advantages of having these vast buildings, and it depends on your area. And it's impossible to make universal principles, but those are the things I've thought about.
Thank you, Paul, very much. As you can tell, we're just beginning to scratch the surface of things like that. Do speak to people like Paul and Nigel and William and others about the advantages and disadvantages of the various denominations. But I think what I want to come out of that, and what I think Paul brought up very helpfully from that, is that the decision about whether to teach the Bible in a mainline denomination and which one is complicated and difficult, and there's no clear-cut advantage or disadvantage. We certainly should not rule out teaching the Bible, seeking to teach the Bible full-time in any of the mainline denominations. For many people, they will be the best place to teach the Bible, the best place for them to serve the gospel. But let us not delude ourselves either. The mainline denominations are not the way we are going to win this country for Jesus. There are just too many disadvantages with them. It's going to be too much of a struggle to take over enough of the churches. The biggest denomination of them all in this country, the Anglican, is coming apart at the seams, as William has said. It's going to be very hard to win the country through the denominations. There are also going to be real disadvantages, real problems, for each of us as individuals applying for those denominations. It's going to be not that easy for somebody from a St. Helens background to be accepted by a free church denomination, even if you decide that is the way forward, because we are tarred with an Anglican brush. And the Anglican Church itself is not going to be that keen on accepting that many of us from St. Helens. We have strong convictions, and they don't like people with those strong convictions. Worse than that, the Anglicans, we look at the Church of England with its hodgepodge of evangelicals and charismatics and high churchmen and liberals, and we think, oh, what a mess. The Anglican establishment works very hard indeed to keep what it sees as a nice balance between all the various different positions, and it isn't going to want to be taken over by evangelicals with strong commitment to teaching the Bible. So, with the best will in the world, we're not going to put many people into the Anglican Church. It's going to start turning us down at some point, however good our candidates. Secondly, even if they accept people like yourself to be trained in the Anglican Church, it's going to increasingly find it hard to find jobs for you subsequently. I'm told by Andrew Jones, who's involved with these things, that one of the biggest challenges in London at the present moment is actually finding homes for conservative evangelical ministers. There are not that many churches that want them. Even so-called liberal evangelical churches, often when they discover that you really do mean what you say, that the Bible is central and that's what you intend to do to teach it, say, no, we don't want you. We want somebody who's going to be a little bit of everything. That's what we mean by evangelical in this church. So just be aware of the situation as it actually is. The mainline denominations are not the way we are going to win the country. There may be a good place for some, but if we are serious about winning this country for Jesus Christ, we need to think more broadly. Yeah. Yeah.
Please don't take this disrespectfully. Is that not to limit the vision that perhaps God could do with the Church of England?
Can I come back to that later on? Let me deal with that briefly now. It's not to, it may be, and we need, to, one of the things I'm going to say is we need to work as hard as we can to do things like turn the denominations around. But, nor do I think, and we'll look at this more later on, that we can just continue to work within the system. That to do that would be, to, I think, to limit, thank God, as well. So, we're not binning the denominations. We're going to work hard. For many people, it's the best place, but we need to think more broadly. So, as we think more broadly, what about the parachurch organizations? There are actually quite a lot of parachurch organizations in this country. The biggest and the best known are organizations like UCCF and some of the summer camp organizations like UN and Lymington Rushmore. What about work within them? Is that a better way forward? Now, they do a great job, but they are actually quite small. We know quite a lot about them. They have quite a high profile, particularly in the circles we move in. But I think we need to realize just how small they are as organizations. UCCF has, Mark will give me the exact figures, I think just over 50 staff workers for the entire United Kingdom. You're not going to win the country with 50, I think it's 54 or something like that, staff workers. It is a small organization. UN, Lymington Rushmore, summer camps, are doing some tremendous work in the circles they're moving with, but they each employ two or three or four people. They are tiny. Further, they are not church, so a lot of good parachurch work is often hindered by the lack of a good church in the area. So I keep speaking to UCCF staff working in various parts of the country who are good men and women doing great jobs with their students who say, I try to teach my students to study the Bible, and they go to the local church on a Sunday, and there is no good local church within reach for these students, and all my work is undone. So I teach them on Tuesdays to study the Bible, and the local church undoes it all on Sunday. There's a limit to how much is going to be done through a parachurch organization. The country, again, I don't think is going to be won through parachurch organizations as they stand. Further, again, thinking about it for us as individuals, working for a parachurch organization is really only a temporary step, because in most of the parachurch organizations, you can really only work for them for somewhere between 3 to 5 years. That's the length of the contract, and in most of them, they don't renew the contract. So all that you do when you work for a parachurch organization is put off for somewhere between 3 to 5 years a decision about what you're going to do after that. Now, I'm not saying don't work for them. They do a great job. It may well be the right thing to take advantage of those 5 years to do a great job with one of them. But don't think it's going to solve the problem either of where you teach the Bible for the whole of your life or how we're going to reach this country. What about, before we go any further, let's look at opportunities for women and opportunities in cross-cultural work. Leonie, can I drag you up? About the opportunities for Christian work. Let me again share a microphone. Let me ask the first one, pass it over, and we'll take it from there. First of all, what opportunities for full-time Bible teaching are there for women in this country?
Thanks, Michael. I think it's probably worth me just kicking off and addressing some of the Anglican situation without trying to kill you at the same time. obviously, there are a lot of women working within the Church of England, who are working within ordained roles. And there are only a very few of those women who I think are modelling a kind of a ministry that I think is a biblical one. Now, I think we all need to go away, men as well, and work out what appropriate roles are for women. And I'm not even going to attempt to open that can of worms now. But there are a lot of women working in roles that actually look incredibly like men's ministry. So you'll see a lot of women who are running churches. So there are women working there. I would say I'm not sure those are actually the best roles for women to be in, or even the right roles. Now, as a caveat to that, I obviously I do know women who are in those roles who are, have chosen not to run churches and are working, trying to work out headship, and may still have decided that preaching is an appropriate way for them to be doing that. I wouldn't agree with them on that, but there are faithful women who are trying to do their best at working out scripture, so don't go and write off every woman who is working in ordained capacity, but I think it is something we need to think through. There are clearly the platforms that Michael has talked about. There are parachurch jobs, and we've got a couple of girls leaving St Helens this year to go and work for UCCF, which is great news. As Michael's also said, schools and summer work. It may well be that in an ordained capacity, girls can go and be school chaplains. That is an appropriate area to be working in. There are summer camp works. Obviously, organisations like Cypher and Pathfinders will also have staff workers backing up church work all year round. So there are opportunities there. But I think the area that's probably helpful for us to be thinking through is what is an appropriate church-based role for full-time women's ministry. And I have to say, there are women working out there, but in many ways it is up to this generation of men and the men that are training at the moment to be thinking about how we can make it possible for women to be doing full-time paid ministry in churches. Women, if they're not wanting to run churches, cannot change that situation from underneath. It's actually up to you guys to make openings for us as you perhaps get into situations where you are running churches and are in decision-making positions. So just bear that in mind. And we will keep nagging from underneath in a gentle, godly way. Right, so, yeah, there are a few girls, and some of you may well know them, who are ordained as permanent deacons and who are exercising great ministries as part of church teams. And they may be working in student work. Another girl I know is working in a more sort of general women's ministry capacity and is running women's Bible study groups, is running sort of outreach groups, and is involved in overseeing youth and children's ministry. So those are the kind of areas that a very few are working with in an ordained capacity. But to be honest, most people are working really outside of the official system and are exercising a great, a range of different ministries really right across the age groups, but predominantly with women or with youngsters and children and the whole kind of mixture of that in between. What do you want to ask me next? Now
Right, let's move on to the next question. You can repeat it for the man. Okay. How does women's ministry look different to men's ministry? How does women's ministry look different to men?
For the tape, how does women's ministry look different from men's? And I think it's fair to say that obviously the principles we're trying to put into practice in women's ministry are exactly the same. So we're wanting to hold the word of God central as being the way that we know Jesus and know God and serve him. That is the absolute fundamental principle. But how that works out looks different. So you're not going to see women necessarily up front an awful lot. A lot of women's work happens in small group Bible studies. It'll happen on the one-to-one. It will involve training, but again, that often happens behind the scenes where you can't see it. Again, with groups or with individuals, it will involve pastoral care. And by that, I mean, obviously, applying God's word to specific situations, but again, a lot of that happens behind the scenes. Now, guys do that as well, but that's where the girls will do a lot of their work. That's their primary work. Obviously involved in outreach, things like Christianity Explored, small groups. There will be opportunities for women to do talks, of course there will, but that will predominantly be to women's groups. It'll be within outreach to perhaps mums and toddlers, that kind of thing. And I think the nature of women's work is that it will inevitably reflect the kind of roles that women have. A lot of women obviously do have children, so whatever you do in a normal setting, you will almost inevitably end up with some involvement in kids' work. So even if you don't end up doing that, you may well have to oversee it and organise it. So it's worth thinking, as part of your investigation at this stage, why not spend a bit of time in Sunday school or in the, you know, in the youth group and see what that's like? It's worth knowing a little bit, even if it's not a specialist area that you try to go into yourself. You will probably end up in a normal parish doing some visiting, either of elderly people or those who are sick. And what you try and do in those times will still be handling the Bible, but that is something that you might do. And in some churches as well, it may be appropriate for women to have some kind of role in actually leading some of the meetings. Even if it's the guards that are doing the bulk of the teaching, that may sometimes happen. It may not in other places. I think that's definitely a negotiable area. I think it's fair to say that women's ministry across the board is going to look a lot more... you probably won't see a lot of it, and a lot of it will be what I call bitty, that's a little unfair, but St Helens is far from normal. You will not have many women who are working in a specialist area, so you won't have many women who are just dedicated to students or who are just dedicated to working with workers. St Helens is far from the norm. It'll often just be one woman trying to deal with the whole of women's ministry across the church. That will obviously mean that she's got to train up some other people to do the work alongside her, but you will be responsible for women, for mums and toddlers, for outreach, for Bible studies, all that kind of thing.
Thank you. And the final question for you, Leonie, is what are the specific challenges that women face as they think about the possibility of full-time Bible teaching?
Sorry to talk about money, but we do come back there again. Paul has obviously started, has raised some of the issues for funding. Training I will leave on one side, but obviously training for women is a big issue, and if you can't do that easily within the official structures, then women do have to look at getting money raised so that they can train. Come and talk to me about that if you want to. I'm not going to tackle that here. But funding is also an issue for jobs, because if you're not working within the official Church of England structures, then there is no automatic salary for you, so churches have to find a way of paying you. Now, there are different ways, therefore, of sorting that problem out. The first way is that actually women will often end up having to do a job that is partly devoted to women's ministry, but also dealing with another need in the church, for example, church admin or something like that. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. That may be the only way that a church can physically afford to pay you and actually get some women's ministry done. So I think you have to live as a woman with just flexibility and being prepared to do that kind of work. It may also mean, as we've already looked at, that you end up having to do ministry in an area that you don't necessarily think is your specialism. So for me, that might mean that I end up having to, at some stage, to oversee Sunday school and youth group. And actually, I have a fair bit of experience in that, but I wouldn't say that's necessarily where I think my gifting lies particularly, or where I enjoy working. But I'm prepared to do that for the sake of actually trying to grow ministry and working with women. And again, just the frustrations really of having a job description that covers everything other than Sunday preaching. It is enormous. And I think, you know, you often, I think, will feel, especially at the beginning, that you're just scratching the surface. So those are some of the things to be aware of. As I said, I think the nature of women's ministry means to you that there are some real frustrations. You are working with people whose lives change all the way along the scale. So you have to be flexible with that. So you may be working with, you know, a fantastic woman who's got loads of gifts, who you would love to be working full-time with you, even in an unpaid capacity, whatever it happens to be. She has kids, which is fantastic, but then actually her then first priority is with her children. That's her main ministry, so you then can't work with her anymore, or you just don't have many hours of her time that you can use. You're working with that kind of dynamic the whole way through. That's fine, that's the way God has made things, but you have to learn to work in a more flexible way. If you're working in church or in a parachurch organisation with students or with children or youth, it is very transient. People come and go the whole time, so it's actually very difficult to build a long-term ministry. What else? I've already talked about doubling up. I think it's fair to say too that a lot of ministry is done by women who are not paid to do it, and I think we've got to be prepared as women to think about that. If, for example, girls end up being married to somebody who is in full-time ministry, I think I'd say, great, that is a fantastic opportunity for you to have a full-time role in ministry. And obviously, if you are in that situation, your first priority is to support your husband and his ministry. But there will be many, many spin-offs actually that, that you can do and contribute really valuably to the ministry of the church. You won't get paid for it, but we're not in it for the money. I think we realised that a long time ago. And I think that means too that I'm not saying you should go out and try and find a husband who's doing that, but I think it that would solve the issue. But I think it is a question to think about. Certainly, if you're, well, guys too, who are you going to have as your wife? Is it somebody who can actually exercise a ministry alongside you and really contribute to the life of the church? And girls the other way around. You know, if you decide to get married, are you getting married to a guy who's actually going to enable you to do ministry? Those are bigger issues than what we've been talking about. I think those are really important to think through. At some point, I may well have to double up responsibilities, as I've said. One of the other ways to get around the funding issue, I think, is for girls to be willing to be flexible. So, for example, would you go back to secular work, or secular in quotes, to earn money so that you could give a day for nothing to a church and maybe try and pump primary ministry or work like that for the long term. If a church really can't fund you, would you be prepared to do that? And I guess it's worth thinking about at this stage, what sort of saleable long-term work skills do I have that I could possibly use in the future to do that? So, for example, I can touch type, therefore I can always work. And it's worth just thinking those things through at the back of your mind. It's my last point, then I'll leave you. Some of the restrictions I think it's worth thinking through. Most women's posts are not long-term. Most are for 2 or 4 years, something like that. Some are long-term, but there aren't many of them. So inevitably in women's ministry, you have to learn to live with not having a lot of security. But that's fine. There are lots of areas where we live with that. So just a challenge, actually, are we prepared to trust in that? That's also the same for some of the guys. It's not just a women's thing, but actually it's an area I think we have to develop, and our area of trust in God to provide. One of the key things is your boss, if you're a woman. You can't really change the way a church runs from underneath. Therefore, you need to choose your boss very carefully. Now, there may be room for a bit of flexibility on his view, specifically of the workings out of women's ministry. There is room for flexibility there. But actually, will he support you in your position? And also, does he have a right view, just more broadly, of gospel ministry? If he doesn't, then it's going to be jolly hard to work under him. And I think lastly, just a thing to think through. It can be a pretty lonely job. St. Helens is far from normal on that basis. Most women on staff teams are working on their own. They will be the only women trying to deal with the whole of women's ministry. And they're perhaps just working with one or two other guys. And that is the scene. It is hard work. It is lonely. And actually, in order to get a paid ministry job, you may end up having to move halfway up the country where you know nobody. It's jolly hard. And I haven't had to do that yet, but we'll face that one as and when. It's a big ask, but again, it's another issue where we have to think, be willing to trust God for. Having said all that, though, I think it's the best job in the world, so don't be too discouraged.
Lini, thank you very much. I really do want to emphasize that point Lini put it in passing near the beginning to us guys, which is, as we think about, or as we go into running churches, we need to think about making opportunities for the women to do ministry. The second, certainly the third, full-time position in a church really ought to be a woman's worker, because half the church, at least, are going to be women. And the best, and even sometimes the right person to work for them, is another woman. So for us guys, as we go off and head up churches, just think about how can we work with the women there in a biblical, gospel way, as well as the guys. What about work cross-culturally? Yet another area, which I hand over to a specialist, Rob.
Not quite sure about a specialist, but... Michael and Paul and Leonie have talked about how to bring God's word to the people of Britain. I wonder what's grabbed your attention. Is it a free church in Bethnal Green, or an Anglican church in Bognor, or UCCF work in Bangor? But what about further afield? How do we bring God's wonderful gospel to nations, languages and tribes outside of Britain? Well, there are some possible options I'm going to list now that that you could go for. These are opportunities that St. Helens is involved in at the moment. And there are many, many more. And if none of these ones particularly grab you, please do come and talk to myself or Helen Foster here, who's on the International Committee. And we will try and sort out particular opportunities that would suit you and your gifts. But the ones we're going to talk about, think about now, are in the three particular areas that St. Helens is trying to reach the world. French-speaking Europe, among Muslim people, and sub-Saharan Africa. Again, there are opportunities cross-culturally in this country, but please come and talk to me afterwards about that, or others here that are involved in international welcome and that kind of thing. Before we say anything about French-speaking Europe, we must recognise that there are Christians in France. We mustn't arrogantly assume that we can go over there and teach them a thing or two. That's completely wrong. As Paul Apparé is here, a faithful Bible teacher, teaching God's word in that situation. There are Christians in Paris and across France. But as Paul, I'm sure, would agree, there are many gospel needs in France generally. as well as there are in this country. And I wonder whether we should be thinking, more of us should be thinking, about whether we can serve God across the channel. Most of us here will have O-level or GCSE French. Now, we may think that that only limits us to order a steak frites, but it's far more Bengali than someone who goes to Bangladesh will have. So it is something that God has given you, so why not think about building on that and serve him in France or Belgium? What's stopping you from getting language-wise? One way that you could test this out is by going on the Paris Fortnight, which happens the last 2 weeks in September. This is an IFES-run evangelism camp outreach where they are working in a university near Paris, reaching the students there and providing training as well. And it's a great way just to see what ministry looks like among students in that country and whether it's something for you. We're also seeking as a church to develop partnerships with churches in Belgium and France, Paul's Church in Paris, but we're also partners with the Trumps in Libremont in Belgium. And Stephen and Ruth Trump are always on the lookout for people, men and women, to help them as pastoral assistants in their church. People who can teach young people, people who can teach men, who can teach women. And see what ministry looks like in a pioneer situation, in a situation where there are very few Christians, where there are very many unreached people. Daniel White is currently there, but he will be leaving next Easter. Why not think about replacing him? What's stopping you from going there? Training is provided, and there's lots of hands-on ministry and seeing what it does look like in quite a pioneer situation. Stephen Orange was a pastoral assistant there back in the mid-90s. He and his wife Dawn are now working amongst students with the equivalent of the Belgian UCCF, doing great work there amongst Belgian students. But they're probably going to be leaving in 2 years' time. So why not think now about whether you might replace them? Why not do a Daniel and then become a Stephen and Dawn? Or just go for it anyway. Get trained up here amongst students and then try and replicate that work amongst Belgian students. It's certainly not easy working in these kind of contexts, though. You are working in a different language. You're working in a different culture. You're often feeling isolated and alone. I mean, Leonie's touched on that already. But I think that's almost doubled in many ways when you're having to speak in a different language a lot of the time. And there's also the sheer slog of ministry, which we've thought about before. But just to give an example of that, Stephen and Ruth Trump have been in Libremont for 12 years, faithfully ministering away, building up a congregation from half a dozen, really their family was their congregation to begin with, up to about 60 now. But still they have nobody who has both the Christian maturity and the Christian gifts who can join them on the leadership team from within that church. They have no one who can be elders with them. So it's a hard slog that they're involved in. It is hard, but is your desire to glorify God greater than the hardships? At St Helens, we're also concerned with people in the Muslim world, and particularly in Bangladesh. And if we look at Bangladesh, there's a real need to disciple new believers. In the past 2 decades, there's been about 20,000 people who've come from a Muslim background to faith in Christ, and they need discipling. They need people to go and get alongside them and help them to see what the Christian life looks like in reality. There's also a key need for people to be teaching the Bible teachers so that they can teach God's word faithfully. Unfortunately, there is only one visa to go to Bangladesh as a Christian teacher. It's just one, and Lewis Farley has that visa, so you can't have it. But there are many, many opportunities to go in a secular capacity, either with a job there, or in a kind of secular work with a mission agency, working in healthcare as an engineer, or working in a university as a lecturer, or working in community development. And you can go there and work alongside Christians. Show what it looks like to be a Christian in the workplace. It's so new to so many people there. And then teach them, get alongside them, disciple them. But again, it's a hard place to minister in. It's physically very demanding. It's a hot and humid climate and full of cockroaches, which I don't like particularly. But ministry-wise, it's also many, many people cannot read and write. You've therefore got to think about how on earth do I teach people the Bible in that kind of setting? There's lots of issues to think about. The church there the established church that has been around there for a few decades in different denominations is also quite a hindrance to work there. In many of them, they've lost an evangelistic edge and so aren't doing evangelism themselves. And some of them are actively preventing Christians from evangelising. So you've got to work within that context. So it's a great place to work and 130 million people to work with. But there are constraints as well. In sub-Saharan Africa, there are many great opportunities there as well. One African church leader has said the church there has become a mile wide, so many people, but only an inch deep. There's a great need for African people, African Christians, to be grounded in the Word, to be taught, again, what it looks like, what Christian life looks like in reality. And a couple of our mission partners are doing that in a slightly novel way. James and Barbara Sherwood were based in Nigeria. James initially was a lecturer there and getting alongside university students, teaching them the Bible and so on. They then came back to this country in the mid-90s, but are still working with their students and their Navigator co-workers in Nigeria, but by writing Bible study materials in this country and then going to Nigeria, training people in that, passing that on for people to teach. Many of us here can write Bible studies. Many of us here can probably write Bible study materials. What a great way that you can serve the church elsewhere, but also enjoy the comforts of Britain, if we do have such comforts. What about thinking about such an opportunity? Don't just limit kind of Bible studies to St. Helens, but take them elsewhere. And Tim and Lorna Cudmore, Tim was here earlier, and unfortunately should have been doing some of this slot, but he's had to dash off to meet someone at Heathrow. Tim is working in Southern Africa for SIM, and he's coordinating the work there in Namibia, Angola and Zambia. What he's doing all the time is trying to keep a gospel focus to the missionaries there, trying to keep them focused on word ministry, on bringing the gospel to the unreached and building up the church. That takes vision, it takes convictions that this is the thing he's supposed to be doing, and real management skills. It's not an upfront kind of Bible teaching role, but it takes real Bible convictions and using some of the skills that the odd management consultant here might have to be used in a Christian way, a really Christian way. But again, it's hard work, especially as many of the missionaries that he works with have different convictions about what Bible ministry involves, are convinced that it means that they should plough all their time and energy into hospitals rather than into building people up in the Word and training Bible teachers. And again, they are quite isolated in what they're doing. They're often alone. They often, as William kind of alluded to yesterday, they haven't really settled in a church, but there are very few churches there that can help them, that can disciple them and can encourage and comfort them. There are many different opportunities, and these are just a few I've listed. But where to go from here? Well, I mean, as Michael talked about earlier this morning, we need to grow now as Christians. Get praying about your godliness. Ask God to transform you in areas where you're struggling. Living and teaching Christ is harder in many ways in a different culture. There are different pressures, different things that you have to grapple with, particularly in how you communicate the gospel and live that out. But you can also get some practice now. Start talking to your Bengali neighbour, or invite your Nigerian colleague home just to get to know them better. Or join International Welcome. The team there greets, meets and witnesses to many different international people in this country. Help out at a Bible study for people for whom English is a second language. Maybe think about Sunday school as well, where you'd get some of the skills needed to teach in a to people who aren't as literate as many of us are here. So where will you serve the Lord? Where will you serve despite the hardships? Will you go beyond this green and pleasant land proclaiming the gospel to others? Opportunities in Belgium amongst students as a pastoral assistant, the Paris fortnight, Bible study materials and many other things. It's not so much Microsoft's kind of where do you want to go today, but where do you want to best use your skills and your abilities and the gifts that God has given you? The whole world's out there.
We're still live. Thank you. So, those then are the current opportunities. In this country, in the... Yep? No, just because I haven't actually got the speciality to talk about them and we don't have the time now. Go on.
Loads of Bible teaching churches all over the country, the second person they appointed a youth worker, and they would love for Bible teachers to come to the youth work and in that sort of thing.
Thank you. Right. Sorry, I'm treading on my wires. Those are the current opportunities, then, for ministry in this country. Opportunities within the denominations, opportunities in parachurch organizations, opportunity with women, opportunities with youth, opportunities cross-culturally. They allow us to do quite a lot of good gospel work, but I hope that we have seen that there are really quite significant problems with all of them. Worse, they will not allow us to make a serious impact on this country or the world for Jesus. They just offer too few opportunities, and there are just too many constraints on some of the biggest opportunities out there, like the mainline denominations. What does the Bible say to us when faced with this sort of situation? And I'm to spend the last 20 minutes or so, just so you have some idea of the timings, thinking about what the Bible says we ought to be doing in this situation. Claire Jackson is going to read 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 to 5 for us.
In the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who will judge the living and the dead, and in view of his appearing and his kingdom, I give you this charge. Preach the word, be prepared in season and out of season, correct, rebuke and encourage with great patience and careful instruction. For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. But you, keep your head in all situations. Endure hardship. Do the work of an evangelist. Discharge all the duties of your ministry.
Thank you. So what is 2 Timothy 4 telling us to do? Does it say, preach the word when the denomination does decide to accept you and will give you somewhere where you can and does provide a salary and a pension? No, it doesn't, does it? It says, be prepared in season and out of season. And when it's out of season, as it is now, jobs will be scarce and jobs will be hard. We're not to give up. We're to keep preaching the word urgently, charged before God, who will judge all people at the end of time. So how are we going to preach the word in an out-of-season time? How are we going to break the mold and reach the country? And we're, I think, on the back of the sheet, just in case you hadn't realized that. How are we going to reach the country and the world, given the restrictions of the system and the fact that must not stop us? I think it means that we have to learn to take the initiative and to teach the Bible despite the system. That's the way the gospel has often been taught in the past. We have lost sight of that. For too long, we have only seen teaching the Bible as something you can do within the system. It has not always been so. And in fact, as you look back over the history of the church, the time that the gospel has advanced most and God has been most honored and most glorified has been precisely those times when Christians have been prepared to preach the word outside the system. In the early church, the Christians preached the word when there was no denomination. There were no established churches. They were being persecuted for their faith, and they preached it. At the Reformation, Protestants were persecuted and thrown out of the Roman Catholic Church, which was the only church Western Europe knew. And to be thrown out of it was a horrific experience. They preached the word, and we look back to the Reformation as being one of the high points, don't we, of the advance of the gospel. In the 18th century, there's what is known as the evangelical revival, when evangelicalism in this country really took off under preachers like John and Charles Wesley and George Whitefield. And the churches in this country were barred to them, so they preached in the churchyards and they preached in the fields. and they had rotten tomatoes and dead cats thrown at them, and they preached the word. And in the 19th century, missionaries like William Carey and Hudson Taylor looked at the unsaved hundreds of millions in India and China, and there was no mission organization working there. So they went. And we look back to that as the founding of the modern missionary movement. Throughout the history of the church, the gospel has advanced most, not when people have been prepared to work in the system with its constraints, but when people have taken the initiative and worked despite the system. And we may be entering that sort of a phase now, when that's what we need to do. So what will taking the initiative and working outside the system look like? Three answers, I think, to that. First, it would be silly to ignore the system. Good gospel work can, as we have said, still be done within it. So let us do what we can within it. Let us send good gospel men and women into their current positions as much as they will accept us and as much as they will allow us to do. They may turn us down, so be it. Let's try. Let's see what we can do within the system as much as we can. Who knows what God will allow us to do there? Let's give it a whirl. But let us not stop when they say no. What else can we do, therefore, when the system says no? Well, we can plant churches, which may be within the system, but need not be. New churches will have their own problems. They won't have buildings. They won't be known in the area. People will think of the new church as a cult. But it does give great freedom to plant in all sorts of places, free of all sorts of constraints and dead traditions. Let's plant. We can grow existing church ministries by increasing the size of the staff team so more ministry gets done in good churches. What that basically involves doing is just making more intensive use of the buildings we have. So instead of the building just being used for one service on a Sunday morning and one on a Sunday evening, it can be used for a couple more services on a Sunday, perhaps reaching different congregations. It can be used midweek for many, many Bible study groups. During the evenings, mums and toddlers during the day, youth on Saturday. You can use the existing buildings far more intensively if you grow your church, your staff team. So instead of it being a small church, it becomes a big church. That will also open up the opportunity for many more specialist ministries, like youth work and children's work, like women's work, like working with young professionals, like specialist Bible teaching work, like work with young professionals. All those begin to open up as you grow a church. And if the congregation is behind it and will fund it, again, you're independent of the denomination. You can also, as William was saying yesterday, begin to grow what we're calling sprouts. So not really a full-blown plant, independent, nor something entirely within the building that you've got, but sort of like a strawberry plant, sending out a runner which sort of sprouts further off down the road. The sort of thing we're doing at Fleet Street on Wednesday lunchtime, or Aldersgate on a Tuesday lunchtime, or St. Peter's on a Wednesday evening, when we're doing works with different groups of people in slightly different places, but all under the umbrella of St. Helens. So St. Helens provides the infrastructure and the support in the Bible study groups. All these are things we are beginning to do at St. Helens, and not just at St. Helens, but many other churches, good churches, that have realized the gospel needs to be spread much more than it is currently being, and that involves the word being taught much more than it is, are beginning to do things like that. So what implications does all that have for people thinking about full-time Bible teaching? If we're beginning to move beyond the mainline denominations and mainline historical homes for full-time Bible teachers, if we're having plants and sprouts and big staff teams, what implications does that have for those of us thinking about full-time Bible teaching? Well, first it means there's going to be a lot more homes for independents who will just be prepared to go and get trained and see what jobs are available out there afterwards. That's the way I went into full-time Bible teaching. That's the way Leonie went into full-time Bible teaching. more and more people are just going and getting trained and then saying, okay, now where are the jobs now? It also means that there'll be more opportunities for people with specialist teaching gifts. People who might not traditionally have thought of themselves as going into full-time Bible teaching because they didn't see themselves as having the gift to be the vicar, the number one in the church. A specialist youth worker, a specialist women's worker, specialist Bible teacher. People like that who might never have seen themselves as a number one now are beginning to find homes, potentially, to teach the Bible full-time within some of the new structures that are coming out of the mold being broken. But we're only at the very beginning of this road, and the way forward will not be smooth. All that sounds great and all that sounds exciting, and I hope that people out there thinking, gosh, does that mean I can actually teach the Bible full-time? I thought that I could only work with women, and therefore would never be able to do it because I could never be the number one in the church. And now I can. I could only ever see myself working with children and could never see myself therefore running a church. But I might be able to teach the Bible full time. And the answer is yes, it does open up a whole slew of opportunities. But we are only at the beginning of the process. And there's a huge amount that needs to be done if we are to make this vision turn into reality and begin to make more of an impact on this country and the world for the gospel. The full implementation lies in the future, and getting there will be a bumpy ride, particularly for those who actually go into full-time Bible teaching. The problem, you see, is that it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. Until there are jobs like that out there in significant numbers, people, individuals like you and me, will be deeply reluctant to go and get trained because you don't know that there's a job there after you've got trained. But until there are people there trained and looking for jobs, churches aren't going to create the jobs. Because as we said yesterday, to train a person from first beginning to start the training, say, as an associate through, say, 2 years as an associate, 3 years at theological college, maybe a couple of years beginning to learn their trade after that and becoming a really fully competent youth worker or women's worker, it might be a 7 or 8 year project. When a church thinks, I want a youth worker, it's not going to wait 8 years for you. It wants one now. If you can't find one now, it will decide that's not the way forward. It'll find another way of solving the problem. It's a chicken and egg situation. Where do you break into the circle of having people, so having jobs, so having people? What it means is people will need to begin to...